and Wolf, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Good. Today we're talking livestock theft. That's quite exciting. Yeah, just a quick introduction. Sean, what do you do? Where do you do it from? And what do you kind of your day-to-day look like at the moment?
Well, Sean Brosnan's my name. I'm a curator at Toi Te Otago Settlers Museum. I've worked here for a long time. My day-to-day work is quite varied, but at the moment I am writing biographical sketches of all of the Dunedin soldiers who died in World War One. I've been working my way through the soldiers who died in 1915. I've written 400 so far this year, and I'm going to do a few more today. And while I'm not doing that, I'm working on our next documentary, which is about the arrival of our Lebanese pioneers in Otago. And we hope to make that documentary next year, but we'll see what happens.
That sounds super interesting. My father was in the army for 26 years. So I'm sure that's always the topics we grew up with. So that's very interesting. Well, same question to you.
My name is William McKee, and I'm the exhibition developer here at Toitū, have been for over a decade now. And one of my principal roles at the moment is I've been busy producing 100 short pioneer stories on people who came to Otago and Southland, principally from Scotland and England and Ireland. And those were written by Sean next to me, and we filmed them in the middle of last year and bits and bobs around here in Otago and Southland. And I've got about 60 of them done now, and we're sort of releasing them weekly. And one of those that he wrote was on a fellow by the name of Mackenzie, who I think you might be interested in talking to us today.
Yeah, totally. James Mackenzie, when I first heard this story, I immigrated here 5 years ago, and the story was immediately interesting. So maybe to both of you, Will, maybe I'll ask you first, what leads you down the path to studying James Mackenzie? Is it what you were doing now, or was there an interest from earlier on?
Well, yes to both, really. Firstly, I did grow up down here in the South Island, and so I was quite aware of a lot of the legends and associated myths about Mackenzie.
Yeah.
And what I was surprised when we looked at this a bit more detail was how it really is a whole Southern South Island story. Growing up, I thought it was really just a South Canterbury-based story, but the feats and supposed feats of Mackenzie actually went right the way down to Murihiku Southland, as well as, you know, North Canterbury. So that was quite interesting. I spoke before about the 100 stories that we're doing on our pioneers. Most of them are about specific people who we specifically know their stories. You know, they left diaries and things.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make sure we gave a little bit of a breadth to that by some different stories, some different things that people encountered. So there's probably two standout characters that we did that aren't so closely associated with our museum, but are important in terms of the story of Scots in southern New Zealand. And that's the Mackenzie you speak of, and then of course Minnie Dean down there in Winton, who was convicted for infanticide. And now those two stories, people did grow up, I think, in southern New Zealand knowing bits and bobs, but we've just tried to put it in a bit more in perspective. And Mackenzie, I mean he's a fascinating character, and a lot of it's hearsay. There's a lot of different things going out, so it was really interesting for Sean to try and delve a little bit deeper into the actual facts. And when we started looking at the facts, we found out there wasn't many to go off, really. There was a lot of different hearsay and bits of information that were strung together, principally actually by one author, by Heres Beattie, in the 1940s. But it's been a real challenge to try and work out exactly what went on with Mr. Mackenzie.
Sean, and for you, where did the interest start?
Well, I have grown up with the legend of Mackenzie. I come from South Canterbury, and my great-grandparents were pioneer farmers in the Mackenzie country, or just on the cusp of it, up near Fairley. And I've got lots of family still up there who've been involved in the local body up there. I've had a mayor of the district in the family, that sort of thing. And as a small boy in South Canterbury, I was quite entranced with the notion of this guy going off into the wilds and his dog. It was a folk tradition that was very live in my childhood in the 1960s. And I've just always been kind of intrigued by him, and, you know, spent lots of time going up into the Mackenzie country, going up to Mount Cook and those sort of areas. And my father also had a role actually in his professional life where he was in charge of fuel supply to the hydroelectric works that were going on in the Mackenzie country in the 1970s and 80s. So, you know, what was happening at Burke's Pass with snow coming down, something was always very relevant in our household because he'd have to be worried about his truck drivers taking fuel up there, that sort of thing. So, yeah, Mackenzie and the Mackenzie country is part of who I've grown up to be. Yeah.
That's very interesting. So if you meet someone on a train in another country and they ask you who James Mackenzie was, how would you in a brief time, in like 3-4 lines, how would you describe James Mackenzie to them? Why is he a legend?
Well, I would say he's a mysterious rogue in the very earliest days of settlement in southern New Zealand who pushed out into the wild unknowns, unfortunately for largely nefarious purposes, who got caught, had a hard time, was pardoned and disappeared from our history, and around whom innumerable legends have wreathed themselves.
Will, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think the only thing that I would add is that, you know, as time passes and things are looked at in a historical sense, we can start to appreciate a bit more of the challenges. Like Sean says, there's plenty of nefarious things around Mr. Mackenzie, but we just know so little about what he actually did. He was really only convicted of the one sheep theft, and yet we think he probably did it 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
And the challenges of the inland South Island in the 1850s of moving stock and the feats that Mackenzie achieved are quite incredible. And Gaelic was his chief language, but it's become apparent that he obviously was quite friendly with a lot of local iwi, a lot of kaitahu people who were able to, mention to him that there was plenty of land further inland than people had broken in. And he was able to pick up on some paths and tracks to use. And like I say, looking back now, he obviously was able to pull off some pretty amazing feats, really.
So it's interesting. I actually didn't know he was pardoned, so we can get into that a bit later. But what does history say he looked like physically?
Well, he was quite a bit taller than the average man in that period. He's about 5'11" or 6 foot. Big guy for that period when people were mostly, you know, much shorter than that.
Yeah.
He was tall and wiry, so quite a slender sort of chap. We got a good police description of him when they were actually hunting for him. So, you know, he had sort of a distinctive appearance, big hook nose. And he also had this strange habit of putting his hands behind his back and clicking his fingers. So, yeah, it might suggest he had a few mental health issues, perhaps. I don't know what it signifies. But, yeah, he was a distinctive looking guy, and people certainly remembered meeting him when they had met him.
Oh, interesting. Did he have a beard? Did they mention something like that?
Well, that's a very interesting moot point, because one of the key things about Mackenzie is the conflicting information that people seem to remember about him.
Yeah.
And we're fortunate here at Toitū Museum. We've got plenty of settler diaries, and we've got accounts of people back in the day remembering meeting Mackenzie. And of course, Mackenzie only really became famous after he got arrested. Yeah. And many of the people, some of them said he had black hair, some said he had red hair, some said a big long beard, others said, oh no, just a traditionally well-kept beard. And there was all these different sort of stories that evolve around it. So I guess, to be honest with you, Christian, yes, he probably did have a beard, but we're not really quite sure whether there's a red beard or a brown beard.
Interesting. It's interesting about his hands behind his back and clicking his fingers. It could kind of be like some anxiety or just some being a bit hyper and wanting to get going. What's the first mention in history of him that you could say is like a reliable source?
Probably the wanted sort of notices by the police and the newspapers, really.
And what did they say? Just wanted for stock theft, or what was
the... Yeah, well, for escaping.
Okay, so that was after the escape, after the he was caught, and then the wanted. So before that, no other mention.
Well, it's a bit hard to say, because as Harry's Beatties makes quite clear, there are gaps in the records of the early land system in Otago.
Yeah.
So it's supposed that he actually formally applied to take up a run, and that there should have been a record of that application.
Yeah.
But no such application has been found, not because there wasn't one necessarily, but because the records of those early runs don't seem to have been preserved. So there may well be the odd record like that. And he may be in passenger lists and things as well. But the trouble with McKenzie, of course, is that he's got two very common names. And, of course, there's quite a lot of uncertainty about that. Is it McKenzie with an M-A-C? Is it McKenzie with a small C? McKenzie with an apostrophe? Is he James or is he John? You know, there are conflicting accounts, even of those most basic things. And when you try and find someone with such a common Scottish name in Scottish records, you need to have other details that you can triangulate around them, such as the name of his parents or precisely where he came from. And we don't have that information about McKenzie. And likewise, were you to look for him in passenger records, you might find lots of J. McKenzie's, and you have no other factor that you can add to that to sort of discriminate between multiple people of that name to say, yeah, that's our man there. So because he's so early here, and because the records that do survive are pretty partial, yeah, pretty tricky to really fix him in the historical record. And that's one of the reasons why he's so fugitive in history, because we can't just lock onto him with great certainty through, you know, bedrock documents.
And then I don't know, were there identification numbers like we have these days? Like, did it exist? How did it work in those times?
For what? For him or for the land or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you carry an ID document, you know, you have a...
No. Didn't even have to have a passport or anything. You know, you could just arrive. If you could get to New Zealand on a ship, well, you were here. You just got off the boat and walked away. No records were kept. The record of passage on a ship was kept because money was involved. You know, so you always got to follow the money for these sort of things. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is from a current point of view. You think coming to New Zealand and just, you know, walking off a plane and away you go. That's the way it was, though, until, you know, early 20th century, in fact.
I think the first official mention of McKenzie is after his trial. So that sort of gives some sort of, you know, perhaps a wee window into that. And even then, we can't really find in records exactly when his trial was. You know, we suspect it was sort of towards the end of May or start of April 1855. But that's, I sort of alluded to that a wee bit earlier, is that's when he became a wee bit more well-known. And so settlers, particularly in South Otago, were able to write, you know, their recollections of McKenzie as appearing sort of in around about the 1853, 1854 around their farms, sometimes doing a little bit of work, sometimes helping out. But I suppose we've all got people like that in our lives, so we might not remember initially, but then if someone, you know, if someone reminds us about someone, we go, oh yeah, that guy. And and you know, there's a range of accounts. Some people think he was a good hard worker, and others think he was a bit of a dodgy character. And through the mist of time, it's really hard to put a finger on it. But certainly that doesn't really help us in terms of trying to gain you know, the official dates that you're after there. But yeah, it was quite big news when he was arrested, because relatively crime-free during the 1850s, early 1850s in Otago, south in the Canterbury. There wasn't a whole lot for the magistrates and things to do. So this was it caused a bit of a sensation, you might say.
And so there were newspaper reports, you know, that we find, not extensive, but, you know, more than you might expect for just an ordinary bloke getting in trouble. Yeah. And, you know, when he did his escapes, you know, there are pretty florid accounts of, you know, who caught him and how they shot him and all this sort of thing in the newspaper. So those are things you can really latch on to. But Heres Beattie's was a great man for speaking to the old pioneers and gathering up their stories. And yeah, you know, we're so fortunate that we had a guy like him, you know, operating in the South and doing that work when he did it, because those people were getting pretty old by the time he started speaking to them. And, you know, we have the difficulties you always face with memory and transmission of stories. But nonetheless, the fact that he gathered up firsthand accounts from people who actually knew McKenzie takes us as close to the person of McKenzie as we can possibly get. And without Heres Beattie's pioneering work, we would never have that source.
So what year did he start that work?
Well, he started doing his historical work in the 1890s, actually, and he, as a very young man, and did it for the rest of his life, and he interviewed pioneers across the South about lots and lots of subjects. He came back to the story of McKenzie kind of late in the piece. I think it's 1946,
the book was published.
43, he published the book. But in the introduction, he talks about how through his whole life of doing all these interviews, as I say, he'd been doing it for decades, the subject of McKenzie had often come up incidentally. So when he went back, and tried to focus specifically on that. He had lots of scattered references to draw together, and you know, it was a bit of a nightmare for him because they were so conflicting, and trying to make a single solid narrative out of it, you know, was hugely challenging. And what he did, as a really good historian, which is what he was, he just put all the things he knew, all the things that had been said together, tried to assemble it into some sort of coherence, but acknowledged that it was kind of a giant mess. And he hoped that some historian in the future might be able to do a better job, but I don't know that we will.
So, most people would listen to this in New Zealand has a frame of reference, but someone from another country doesn't. Just maybe run me through why he appears in history, why he's notorious, and then just maybe his trial and how that worked.
Well, I guess the first thing to point out is that 1850s New Zealand, really Europeans had probably only mainly been interacting in New Zealand for about 60 years on a large scale at that point. And even then, it wasn't many people. It was a lot of people, Europeans are mainly in settlements around the coast. Dunedin was only founded in 1848, Christchurch 1850. And we're talking about a guy who appears in the historical records in the mid-1850s. Yeah. So that the hinterland of South Island hadn't really been broken in or used. But about the 1850s, sheep started to be imported mainly from Australia, and some run holders took up land, and particularly Highlanders became wanted for their knowledge of use of their shepherdry skills.
You're talking Scottish Highlanders.
Yeah, yeah. Scottish Highlanders. Yeah, and yeah. Basically a huge estate in South Canterbury, which was owned by the Rhodes brothers, known as the Levels, near modern-day Timaru. They noticed on two or three occasions that they was all of a sudden missing 500 sheep. Now,
oh wow,
this is not farms as we know it today. These were huge, big areas of not improved land. They really didn't have many fences. You had shepherds out looking after them, but by day, but by night, they might be brought into pens or they might be let out. What? So it was kind of a wee bit ambiguous, but they started noticing that these mobs were going missing. And you know, so it became quite public knowledge. I think we mentioned earlier that, you know, there were notices put in early newspapers and things. But
yeah, by the Rhodes brothers.
Yeah, by the Rhodes brothers. And basically, you know, we don't want to make too many claims, but we assumed that this was this bloke McKenzie was using his great skills to take these sheep, but then he was taking them all the way down to Southland through the interior of the South Island, which wow. was only at that stage known to the local tribe of Maori people, the Kaitahu people. And he was crossing huge big rivers, going through unbroken land into a wee place where he thought that he would be able to keep these sheep safe. So he was basically a sheep thief. And
but so audacious, you see, because that countryside, it's sort of like the Wild West. You know, you think of the American West and people forging across the frontier. Well, in New Zealand, the frontier was really close to the coast.
Yeah.
And most settlers weren't even interested in going inland. They were very concentrated on little bits of land that they broke in just around those coastal settlements. So someone who was prepared on their own to venture into the mountain fastnesses and the country in the interior of the South Island is really epic country. You know, yeah. it's on a par with sort of, you know, some of those Wild West terrains in the United States. There's yeah. huge mountains, there's fast-flowing rivers, there's, you know, it's the rocky ground, there's, you know, it's challenging. Yet he went through that country on his own when, it, you know, exploring, really yeah. being, you know, the first Pākehā man to sort of do it, and found passes and found ways, and as Will said, crossing the rivers. Now, it's known that he wasn't able to swim. So how did he get across the rivers? Well, he had a bullock, and he just hung on to the tail of the bullock and let it swim him across the rivers. Now,
so that's a castrated bull. Is that am I correct?
A bullock is a big, heavy animal that will you know, that's used for carting.
Okay.
So basically, what you said, but you know, it's really for dragging a cart. So that was his workhorse, if you like. You know, a bullock. You could load it up lots of gear and haul along, but he used it also as his way of getting across rivers. Now, if you've been seeing some of these rivers, even if you're a very competent swimmer, you'd be, you know, thinking twice before launching in and trying to swim across some of those currents and things. But Mackenzie, who couldn't swim, he ventured into them, icy cold water often, just by hanging onto his bullock's tail. And away he went. And at the same time, with just his one dog, he was marshalling all these blooming sheep, hundreds of sheep, you know, across this sort of country that Will's just described. So I think that's why people came to admire him so much, because of the audacity, kind of foolishness, bravery, skill, competence, all those things were wrapped up in that. So even if he was stealing the sheep, by God, what a challenging task it was. And, you know, he pulled that off. So, you know, kudos to him for that, for his skill and his audacity.
Yeah. How large was that area that he purportedly covered?
Well, I guess to put it in miles, they say as the crow flies, it's close to 200 miles.
Yes.
Which is, that's, you know, mad. And I mean, nothing in the south of New Zealand's in a straight line, pretty much.
No.
It was, you know, long times. So it really was months at a time it took for him to move these sheep through the interior. I think we probably need to highlight the fact that he obviously had contact with local iwi, local Maori, who were able to give him some pretty good bits of advice. It's thought that he probably moved these sheep in the winter when the large rivers we've spoken of, there's two or three particularly huge ones, the Waitaki and the Plutha, the Mata'au. And he suggested trying to go in the winter. Well, sorry, the Maori people obviously suggested to him going in the winter when these water levels would be lower. He, as Sean said, must have had a few adventures. And this was by himself as well. There's, you know, we might talk later on about his dog, but the dog was obviously his only company. And yeah. I think also in the 1850s, the difficult nature of the New Zealand land system was that you could apply to lease these large runs, but you needed to stock them with sheep. And as we've said, yeah, you needed to get sheep mainly from Australia to stock them. So this was quite difficult. And some early settlers remember Mackenzie telling them he was expecting sheep to arrive, maybe at Port Chalmers, maybe down there at Bluff. And he was kind of going between the two ports, waiting for the sheep to arrive. But it's more highly likely he was possibly scoping out actually, you know, locations to get these sheep, because it's known that he did work on a lot of these early runs. And so he was able to gather a lot of information together, which then helped him execute these, whether they were by chance, but it's more likely that it was, you know, very well planned heists, if you will, of sheep all the way from up there in South Canterbury down into our deepest Southland.
Yeah, because you see, if he'd applied for that run, he was on a ticking clock. There's a certain amount of time in which he had to stock the run with a certain number of sheep, you know, per hectare of land. And as a pretty poor man, it cost bugger all to take out the license for the run.
Yeah.
But stocking it with the sheep, that was the big challenge. And he just couldn't afford to buy sheep. So his alternative was, well, I'll just borrow someone else's. And, you know,
it's interesting because obviously he's paving the way for with confusion. He doesn't know what port it's going to come in. So, you know, people say, oh, well, he probably got it from the other port. So he's pre-preparing. And then if you look at, you know,
Yeah, well, the other thing about that too is that because of the vastness of the land area, even no one would see them going through because there was no one to see them, you know? So he had the sort of cloak of just the emptiness of the land, which gave him the freedom to roam and check things out and find spots and keep his sheep somewhere for a while. No one would come across him because there was no one there.
He must have had a epic sense of direction because, you know, before I go hiking or do a bit of hunting, you've got Google Maps, you've got the topo app that you can use to see where the valleys are, what heights you're going to cover. And even then, it's sometimes difficult. But he does this basically blind.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I'll just go back to the earlier point where we said there was only so many runs that had actually been stopped. And these early settlers all kind of remember him. So he really knew farmers that were around. So you're correct. He obviously had a really epic sense of direction. He knew where there were people. There's one story, for example, that a day after he had visited someone, there was a huge big, the whole valley got covered in smoke, and that someone had set a fire further up, and they suspected in retrospect that was probably Mackenzie setting a fire to clear land to bring stock through. So he had a pretty good idea of where people were and where they weren't. And you know, he was able to piece together the differences between the, because it was a provincial system in those days, you know, the Canterbury province was different from the Otago province. And new runs up in Canterbury, He knew runs down in Otago. There weren't many runs in Southland at that stage, even though that's where he ended up applying for a run and keeping some of his sheep in Edendale. And it's interesting to note that some years after he was arrested and had vanished, some of the sheep that he had actually stolen were still known to be grazing, because sheep back in those days were marked with brands, and some of the poor old Rhodes Brothers sheep were still roaming around parts of Southland being found. So that's another part of the mystery. We'll never quite know the full extent of his exploits.
The other thing too, I suppose, about his sense of direction in relation to that type of mountainous country,
yeah,
is that he was a Scottish Highlander. Yeah. And a lot of the country in central Otago does look remarkably like some of the big straths and, you know, valleys of Scotland. When we were over there last year filming our stories, we didn't have a particular place where we could locate Mackenzie, because where he actually comes from in the Highlands is just unknown. Yeah. But, you know, we went looking for lots of other Highlanders' origin points. So we were roaming pretty widely across the Highlands. And time and again, we looked at the scenes and thought, my God, that looks just like central Otago. You know, so there would have been a sort of sense of familiarity and with the way that the land works, I suppose, you know, mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers. And he was a man of the land and of mountainous country.
And obviously used to hardship as well. A couple of the accounts record that when he reappeared at farms, he was skin and bone and looked quite ragged, like he had done it hard, but wasn't really forthcoming necessarily as to what he'd been up to. But yeah, he obviously knew how to sustain himself, but only just, because it's you know, some of the accounts are quite frightful of how he was looking very very unwell after some of these expeditions into the hinterland.
Yeah, and of course,
there's not a lot of food sources either. I mean, you know, some of those areas are kind of great food deserts, really.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. You know, if in Scotland there would have been rabbit, there would have been hare, there would have been some native sheep, there would have been deer. Where he, at that stage, none of those were really prevalent. It only took hold, I believe, later.
Yeah, that's right.
So how does it ramp up to him being caught, and how is he caught?
Well, again, there's differing accounts as to the hows and whens, but in South Canterbury, he obviously tried to steal again from the Levels estate, the Rhodes brothers, and he was actually tracked, because this time he tried to take a much bigger mob, and they think that close to 1,000 sheep were missing, but this time he was tracked by one of the local Kaitahu shepherds who were working for the Rhodes brothers. And he went and got their, you know, this with the manager, the overseer, whose name was John Sidebottom. And, you know, some accounts say there was two or three of them, but they managed to track Mackenzie down to a pass quite close to where it opens up into what's now known as the Mackenzie country. And, yep. And again, the counts vary, but some say that he was sort of, passively claimed that he was just taking these sheep for, you know, another man. And then other accounts say that there was a struggle ensued, and that, you know, it was, there was a fight, and that he had to be bound and all these sorts of things. But anyway, that's him being captured and arrested the first time. But even that's got a heck of a story, because that night, as they were making camp, John Sidebottom feared that actually Mackenzie wasn't alone, and you would suspect he wasn't alone because back in those days you'd have a team of people moving so many sheep. You wouldn't just have the one person by himself.
Yeah.
And there was a disturbance, and they decided, right, we better go straight back to the station, which again was, you know, the best part of a day's ride or walk. But Mackenzie managed to talk some people into loosening his bounds, and of course he bolted and escaped. And he managed to escape all the way to Littleton, which is, a long, long way on foot, and possibly through the interior of Canterbury, which is not as it is today with, you know, nice plains. It was a lot of marsh and boggy and sort of tussock land. Yeah. But anyway, he managed to make it to Littleton, where he was hoping to escape on a boat somewhere. But when he got there, the boat wasn't ready to go for a week, and the law eventually caught up with him. So that's sort of that part in a nutshell. I don't know, Sean, if you've got anything to add to the capture of Mackenzie.
Well, no, that's it. Yeah. So again, these epic feats of walking long distances at high speed, short time, that added to as a lure for the ordinary people who knew just how bloody it was to walk across the Canterbury Plains. And then, of course, you know, failure to get away, being caught. Well, this proved to be very challenging for Mackenzie, being put in jail. He didn't like it. Then doing hard labour, he really struggled. So again, he made a number of other escape attempts. He did escape, and he was recaptured on more than one occasion. So those all things, you know, again, built the legend of Mackenzie, this incredible guy who took on these incredible feats and, you know, didn't want to be bound, didn't want to be tied down, struggled against his bonds. And then he played up that idea in court and in popular memory that he couldn't understand English. He played dumb, you know, which is a great trick of people who's, you know, for whom English is a second language. Sometimes it pays to just pretend you don't really know what's going on, even if you maybe do. And he played that card quite frequently.
Of course, he's lucky he wasn't in the USA, because then he probably would have been hung.
Yeah, he probably would have been. That's right. No, he had some nice English people running the show in Christchurch, and they were pretty committed to law and order and due process and that sort of thing. So perhaps he was lucky to be where he was.
So then he was... like, this is the part I'm unclear about. He gets pardoned and then he disappears, or does he escape again? How does he build up to that?
Well, firstly, just on the escapes, I mean, the records are a wee bit sketchy, but he may have escaped up to four times. And one of them was quite a epic escape where he was gone for nearly a week. And it was, you know, well away from Christchurch where he was actually apprehended. And then coming back to Christchurch, he escaped from the escape.
Oh my!
And they
word.
Had to shoot him, and he got quite seriously wounded, and that was the way they eventually caught the poor guy. Those escapes, it's thought, actually made them realise, you know, this is a real nuisance for our resources here. Having this Highlander, we don't really want him in our prison, and they thought, well, is there a way that we can get rid of him? And you know, Harry's Betty looked into it and said, well, there was a time when the governor actually visited Christchurch, and in, I don't know, it's kind of similar, I guess, to the account of Jesus and Pontius Pilate, where they would release a prisoner under the good wills of the visit of the governor.
Yeah.
And it's thought that Governor Gore Brown possibly, you know, granted this guy clemency. But it's the records are void of why he was released, but it's quite likely that it was the resource it was taking to look after this guy, because they'd take them out every day for hard labour, and there'd be one guard looking after most of the prisoners, and they reckon there was three guards looking after Mackenzie. He was just an absolute liability.
Yes.
And they believe that he was probably released on the condition that he left the colony, and that way he wasn't going to take up anyone else's resources of looking after this guy, because he was sentenced to 5 years. Hard labour, and he was probably released after about 9 months, in which time he did, you know, those three or four escape attempts, got shot, and made a lot of people annoyed. So quite the legacy.
And the other thing, of course, was the language thing. They used that as a kind of a factor that he hadn't had a fair trial because then what was going on was his language. But the pioneers knew that he could understand and speak English perfectly well.
But just on that, there's a two. It's saying that he couldn't, playing up the, you know, the English part of the trial, that he couldn't understand what was going on. And of course, he had a close affinity with his dog. And they, towards the end of the trial, said, right, well, what are we going to do with the dog? And the judge said, well, I suppose we'll have to destroy him.
Oh.
And allegedly Mackenzie jumped to his feet and, in quite good English, said, please don't do that to my dog. I'll do anything.
That's it. Well, is that confirmed or is that legend?
Well, it's a bit of a legend that was passed down, but by someone that was at the trial, because that's the annoying thing, Gerard, was the trial wasn't really, we haven't been able to find any records of the trial. So it's all, much of what happened in the trial really is hearsay.
Yeah, it's very early days in the colonial period too. That's worth remembering. You know, progressively things ramped up in terms of, you know, systems and processes and recording apparatus. But in the very early days in Otago and Southland, you know, the records are pretty scanty.
Yeah. Is there any more about how he was shot? You know, does it say where he was shot? Is there any other details on that?
Yeah, there's a little newspaper report that he was recognised by these guys when he arrived at this destination. I can't quite remember where it was. Somewhere in Canterbury there.
North Canterbury, I think, yeah.
They spotted him, grabbed him, then he made a dash for it. So one of them shot him. You know, he was recaptured. He wasn't too badly wounded. And then the newspaper account says that he had no hard feelings and he, you know, said he'd been treated well and all this sort of thing. But so the newspaper report is what we've got to go on there.
He had no hard feelings. I think if I was shot, I probably would have some hard feelings.
Yeah, me too.
Then his dog, you know, we can talk about him disappearing from history, but his dog interests me. Like, what do you know about his dog? Is there anything confirmed about the dog, or is that mostly just kind of those accounts taken from old timers?
Well, I suspect he possibly had more than one dog. Okay. Because when I hear about the different descriptions of the dog, they really sound quite different. Some describe the dog as a black and tan dog, and others describe it as a collie, which is, you know, a white and black dog.
Yeah.
And others say that, you know, the dog was trained not to bark. I suspect it was probably a collie dog doing the kind of moving that he was doing.
Yeah.
And there are different stories as to what happened to the dog. One of them is actually that the Rhodes brothers, one of the owners of the estate that actually Mackenzie, you know, was caught from stealing from, that he actually went to an auction and bought the dog after Mackenzie was imprisoned and had a very happy life with the dog on his farm. Hmm. Whereas other stories are that the dog would only, its commands were all in Gaelic, as were Mackenzie was, you know, that was his chief language, and that people were lining up to purchase this dog at this auction afterwards, but then of course no one could work it because, you know, few people could you know, knew the Gaelic commands, and so the dog was kind of rendered useless. So yeah, there's a fair bit going on there, but I think one thing that can definitely be assured of would be that there was a very close bond between Mackenzie and this dog, because it was probably one of his only sources of companionship for some of those feats of hardship that he endured.
Yeah, and shepherds are always pretty close to their dogs as well, of course. You know, they're life partners and working partners. When I was growing up, Jared, you know, there's the little statue of the dog in Tekapo, just outside Church of the Good Shepherd. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, it's the first real contact I had with kind of Mackenzie after I immigrated here.
That little statue isn't really to Mackenzie's dog. It's a tribute to all the sheepdogs who, you know, were involved in breaking the country. But as a kid, I thought it was Mackenzie's dog. That's what I always thought. So to me, whenever I see that, I always think of Mackenzie and his dog. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, there is the great statue now in Fairlie.
Yeah,
of,
that's right.
Of Mackenzie and his dog. Yeah. And that, you know, it's been very well done by the artist of them looking like they're sneaking up on sheep or something. It's a, you know, it is epic. But so it's a bit of a shame we don't know more about the dog, other than they think it was called Friday. But that was the name that was given to it after Mackenzie had been imprisoned. So, and there is a sadder story that the dog was shot after Mackenzie was captured too. So, you know, all those stories mixed in the melting pot, and we're not exactly sure of what became of the dog.
Well,
I thought the dog was a real hero of the story.
Yeah, I also think so. I hope he spent his days on the Rhodes farm. That's the story I think would be the best. So. How does he disappear out of history? Like, what is known or what is thought?
Well, that's again a reflection of the scanty nature of the records. You know, people weren't tracking your movements in those days. If you wanted to go somewhere from Canterbury, you paid a fare on a ship, away you went. See ya. And the likely place he went to is Australia, Melbourne. But where he went to from there, he just disappears into the huge mass of humanity that was surging all around the globe at that point. And a man called Mackenzie, there were so many Mackenzies, so many John Mackenzies, so many James Mackenzies.
Yeah.
It would be impossible to track him unless you knew exactly his age or, you know, and he did something else that brought him into a written record. He was in a court case in Australia, for instance, but you need to be able to triangulate the details so you know that it's the same guy. Very difficult to do with a name so common. So yeah, he disappears into history. But there is the story that Will probably want to tell you about Ralph Swale's account of having met him subsequently on a return visit.
Yeah, so there was an early settler called Ralph Swale who was the thing that we, the reason we give this story a bit of weight is because he was a reputable chap, you know, and he lived down in a place called Tyree Ferry or Tyree Mouth in the area between near Waihola and the coast and south of Dunedin here. And he quite vividly remembers Mackenzie reappearing in the late 1850s. And because Swale had known him earlier before he was arrested. And he said, look, I'm off back to Edendale where my hut was because I want to get my belongings. And then I'm off to America. And so this story's been passed on that Mackenzie came back. And from that too, there's a lot of stories that Mackenzie had, you know, buried treasure and all sorts of things down there. But the truth is it probably wasn't buried treasure because he was, you know, he didn't get a chance to sell his sheep or anything, but he wanted his belongings. And he'd been quite clever where he'd set this hut up down there in Edendale because it was an area to local Maori that was tapu, or, you know, they were told to never go. And so Mackenzie thought, well, if I set up there, I'm quite likely to not be disturbed. So that's an incredible sort of account of what was going on. And he came back. And then there's a couple of other accounts too that people said that they saw him over in Australia working on sheep runs over there. But it is likely that as part of his pardon, he was told, you know, get out of town and don't come back.
Well, I mean, if he kept up with what he was doing in Australia or in went to America, he certainly would have met a different fate than he would have met here, because they were definitely not as gentle in terms of repercussions in those countries.
Well, that's probably right. I think we probably need to underline the fact that period there wasn't a heck of a lot of known crime going on in Otago or Southland or Canterbury, So that when this did happen, it was quite a bit of a sensation. And then he was caught, and then most people just assumed that even though he'd been caught, he had accomplices. And then so there was a lot of sort of sideways glances going on at anyone trying to work out who he was working for, or, you know, they thought there must have been some sort of higher power behind this. But, you know, the more we look into it, there's a good chance that people just weren't probably paying his dues of what a skilled shepherd Mackenzie was, and probably a skilled thief.
So there's no record of sales. So you think he never had any chance to sell any of those sheep?
Well, he wasn't really trying to sell them in the first place. He was trying to stock his land. Yeah. And then once he was caught, well, they weren't his in the first place. I don't know if the Rhodes brothers were a couple of them. I don't know about that.
Well, interestingly, that's why I think there might have been two or three mobs, because they think he might have actually left one on one side of the Waitaki River. Yeah. And that was recovered at one point. But the ones that went all the way, you know, because he was still putting, the Rhodes brothers were still putting ads in the paper after Mackenzie got arrested, saying, hey, has anyone seen our sheep? You know, this guy's not coming clean about where they are. And that's the interesting thing, how some with their brand was sort of reappearing all around Southland in the late 1850s.
Do you know how was she branded in those times? Was it ear tags or ear cuttings? Is there any indication of that?
No, I'm not really too sure, to be honest, because I'm just going off what these accounts were saying. If they had, sometimes they don't say brand, sometimes they say the mark of the Rhodes brothers.
They did have brands. We've got examples of the brands in the museum collection. You know, the metal prongs that you'd heat up and then stamp into the animal.
Yeah. Would it be a brand on the body or the ear?
No. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure about sheep. Well, certainly with cattle, you'd be on the body. I don't know how they got them. I'm not a practical farming character, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So that might be a bit beyond my ken.
And are there any accounts of a wife or of children?
No. There is a very interesting story of how Blythe Mackenzie was. There's this guy called Freddie Mieville, who was one of the very first to take sheep down to Southland. And he was a young Englishman. Well, actually, he was of Swiss origins. His family lived in England for a long time, so he was effectively English. And he'd come out here as a young man to have adventures. And one of the adventures was to operate a sheep station. So he was operating the sheep station down south, and he did have a wife. He romanced a young woman from a very similar sort of family on the ship out, and duly married her and took her down to his primitive hut down in the wilds of Southland. So they were living in this really basic hut, young married couple. And one day Mackenzie turned up soaking wet. He just walked into the house, stood in front of the fire and took off all of his clothes till he was standing there absolutely naked. And he took no notice of the fact that poor Mrs. Mayville, this young English woman of refined background, was standing on the other side of the room. He didn't take any notice. He just stripped off to dry his clothes.
A practical man then.
Yeah.
So on that story, for both of you, what's kind of your favorite legend or something that is are in the records that about the story? Like what really like stands out to you, or what do you kind of think about?
Well, for me, my favorite part of Mackenzie is this memorial in Mackenzie Pass. It's an old stone monument with three different faces to it. And there's an inscription there saying that it marks the site where he was caught, captured by Sidebottom and the two Maori guides on a particular date. But the thing that I love about it, I remember visiting this as a kid. My dad took us up into that area, and it's quite remote. You have to go down this long shingle track to get there. It's not on the main highway. And, you know, really evocative because, you know, when we went there, all I could think about on the journey home was this, you know, excitement of the nighttime capture and the escape. So it was, you know, there weren't many stories like that around South Canterbury, but this is one that was really something to fire your imagination. The thing I like most about that monument is that the inscriptions on each face are in a different language.
Hmm.
So the first is in English, then there's one in Maori, and then the last one is in Gaelic. You know, so it really sort of sums up the connections of three different groups of people, their different aspirations for the land, and the way those three cultures just came up against each other on that fateful night over that story of Mackenzie and his traducing of the laws, customs of the place.
And will you?
Well, I just think it's a well-known story, but poorly known. And for me, I just love the fact that it's a really sort of that pioneer period of the South Island. It really covers pretty much a much wider area than initially thought, because Mackenzie Country is, you know, a beautiful big basin area in South Canterbury, but really it extends down to the north Otago, Otago and Southland when you consider the feats that are taken. And if I could just touch on one quick story again.
Yes, please.
There's many of these stories, but one account talks about how one of the times that he stole the sheep, he actually saw the shepherd, you know, bringing them in for the night. And so he went down with his dog and started chatting to the shepherd, who obviously knew him from the past. And he was giving the dog its commands in Gaelic, and the dog suddenly vanished, and the shepherd didn't think too much of it, and he said, see you later. And then he woke up in the morning, and he invited Mackenzie to stay with him for the night. And then they woke up in the morning, and the sheep were all gone. And Mackenzie said, oh, look, I'll give you a hand. I'll go this way, and you go that way. And, of course, the poor old shepherd never saw the sheep again. And so it took the dog by itself and rounded up these 500 sheep, and it started off towards the journey that Mackenzie had trained it to. Now, of course, I mean, there's a lot of potential bollocks in that, but it's just the sort of stories that have grown up. I think in the wee film we made, Sean said that, you know, without Mackenzie being around to set the record straight, you know, legends about him grew up like weeds.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's just so many different things that could have happened. And we're just really not too sure, but it all adds to the mystique of the man. And as we said at the start of today, I think that's possibly why he's so endeared to people now, is because of all of these things mixed up together and what we take out of it. You know, Sean takes out of the fact that maybe the collie statue at Tekapo, he always thinks of Mackenzie's dog when he sees that.
Yeah.
And the fact we don't even really know whether his first name was James, John, or Jock.
Yeah.
You know, all we've really got, even the newspaper accounts vary with that first name. It's just probably one of our first really pioneer folklore heroes, to be honest.
It's super interesting, and you know, knowing dogs, I think a dog would be able to pull off such a feat. That's just kind of what comes to my mind, you know, like something like that could be completely right, that the dog just kind of knew where to go and then kind of helped with the job. So it's fascinating how these legends of early pioneers and their animals really, you know, fascinate us. There's a legend it's a book that was written, Jock of the Bushveld in South Africa, about one of the early pioneers who bought the runt of a litter And then this dog became his hunting companion and already became a legend in his day. But then one night when the dog was trying to stop a jackal from eating chicken, someone shot it. They thought they were shooting at the jackal and then they shot the dog. And I grew up on this legend. And I think also that's why something like James McKenzie really, really appeals to me. At what point is it officially called McKenzie Country?
I don't think that you got to think that in that early period, there wasn't a geographical board who were making, you know, formal decisions about nomenclature. Just things sort of evolved. So from a pretty early point, people were referring to the country as McKenzie's Country.
Yeah.
You know, and they're trying to describe that great inland basin that he had opened up.
Yeah.
And over time, I think that just ossified into the McKenzie Country.
Yeah.
With, you know, different spelling to the way he spelt his name potentially, you know. So yeah, no, I don't think there's any formal point at which that happened. It just evolved. Any thoughts on that?
No. Although just before we came on air there, I did mention to Sean that the person that then confirmed that the country had been found was the person that captured McKenzie, yeah. John Sidebottom of the Levels Estate. Now he was able to say, look, he was able to pass on to everyone, there was especially his employers, that there is a great tract of country just beyond the Snowy Mountains where we caught McKenzie. And so it was possibly you know, a stroke of fortune that it's known as the McKenzie Country, not the Sidebottom Country.
Yeah.
So sure. may have been quite different. But here is Beattie notes that it's quite rare in New Zealand for us to then talk about an area being called, you know, a country. It's more a foreign thing, so it is quite special and unique in New Zealand. I think the other example it gives is the King Country, but other than the King Country and McKenzie Country, they are two of our more well known sort of areas.
Yeah, they're very unique as names for New Zealand. It's not a style that's been adopted generally. Yeah.
So, what other stories do you think are worth mentioning as we kind of draw to a close?
Well, the hut in Edendale, yeah, and the buried treasure. So it's very unlikely there is any buried treasure because he never had any damn treasure. That's kind of the point. But, you know, naturally people thought, oh, you know, he had this little hut tucked away there. And that area, of course, Edendale has subsequently become a huge dairying place. You know, historically it's where the first big dairy factory was established in New Zealand.
Yeah.
But I found it quite intriguing to go there when we filmed to find the spot. What was it called originally? It wasn't called Edendale at that point, was it?
Well, they know it as Edendale Bush. And, of course, everything in Southland was bush. But bush after it was now beautiful farmland, not a bush in sight in some places. But
yeah. No. So that's kind of a bit intriguing, that you know, the legends of the buried treasure, which is just so folkloric, and that, you know, how would there be any damn buried treasure? This guy was as poor as a church mouse, and he was stealing sheep to sort of get ahead. And he never got ahead, so there's unlikely to be any treasure. But, yeah.
And did they find that hut? Do they know where it was exactly, or is that also a mystery?
Yeah, well early settlers certainly said yes, it was a common place where you'd stop off. Again, early Southland wasn't broken in for sheep runs as early as other places like Otago and Canterbury. Most of the settlements were around the coast, but there was some famous droves of cattle in the early 1850s across Southland into Otago, and people mention, oh yes, no, that's where we stopped off at McKenzie's hut. It was referred to for a while, and apparently and this adds a bit of the legend that he did have accomplices, because people would say, well, in the hut there wasn't just sort of one set of crockery, there was sort of you know, a whole set, and so maybe that's part of the accomplices. But apparently that started to get pilfered by early settlers and other people you know, across the years, and some people mentioned right up until the late 1800s that, you know, this hut was still there in a very dilapidated state.
Mm.
It probably was a pretty primitive hut too, because, you know, those first houses, accommodation that people built for themselves in remote areas, tended to be wattle and daub huts, and they're pretty shacky, you know.
Yeah.
Not too elaborate. Even a guy like Freddie Meavel, you know, who came from a pretty prosperous background, he was really slumming it in his little place down there, taking his bride. They didn't stay there very long. They went back to England pretty quickly and, you know, ended up living in the stockbroker belt of central London, where we visited his grave.
But I love the different accounts too. Everyone speculated for a long time how he brought the sheep down from South Canterbury. into Southland, because looking at the map now, there's probably two or three ways that would make sense, just geographically. But these all varied greatly, from as wide out as the Nevis Valley and Lower Wakatipu over to the Old Man Range and down the Waikai Valley. Further up, you've got, did he bring them through the Lindis Pass and down through past what's modern Cromwell? Do they take them over down the Manuhirakia Valley or down through Middlemarch? There's just so much speculation as to how it happened. And when they did track one of the mobs of sheep, they were managed to find them down by the Waitaki, which meant, and so they just naturally thought that they'd gone down the Hakateramia Valley. But on closer inspection, you'd take them up further, way up further towards where Omarama is now in that area. And that leads to the legend too of the whole making sure you crossed where the river was a bit lower, which would make sense, and during the winter. And so you put all these things into account. It's like, well, gosh, he really could have taken them anywhere, because there was no one really to bump into. One of the earliest European explorers, Nathaniel Chalmers, so I think it was 1852 or 1853, he got a couple of his friends who were local kaitahu, Maori, to take him up through so he could have a bit of an explore of that hinterland. And he's attributed as the first European to see places like Lake Wakatipu and got as far up as Lake Wanaka before he became really ill and he had to be ferried down the Clutha, basically to save his life because he was so ill. And, if he's the first guy up there in 1852 or 1853, well, this is Mackenzie's going through there about that same period. And he's not loudmouthing about being a discoverer. He's keeping it quiet for his own nefarious purposes. So it's really is quite fascinating to speculate. And you can see how, with a lack of official records, how stories spring up like weeds.
What are you busy with now for the next couple of weeks?
Well, the stories of the 100 Pioneers is a big output for us. It's on our YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And it complements a major documentary we made last year in Scotland and England and Ireland called The Journey to New Edinburgh, which backgrounds the whole settlement and development of early Otago. And Mackenzie feeds into that at a minor level. But we wanted to complement the big story with these little micro stories of individuals, why they might have left their homes in Scotland, England, Ireland, and what brought them to Otago, because they had so many places they could have gone around the world, particularly America. That's where most of the Scots went. So why did they come here? And how did they get on? Were they successful in what they were aspiring to do? So looking at 100 different individual stories builds up quite a big picture. And it took us all over Scotland and around quite a bit of Ireland and a few places in England to find out where the people came from and film those places. So Will was working hard now at putting all that work together and incrementally releasing the videos. So if anyone's interested in some of those pioneer stories, they are all pretty interesting in their own right. Mackenzie stands out as the one big criminal we did, I suppose, if you exclude Minnie Dean from that. The rest tend to be, farmers and tradesmen who came and worked hard and prospered. So the 100 Pioneer Stories is what we're working on to pull that together, because 100's a lot.
There's about 25 now that people can see on the YouTube channel. And obviously I think I've got about 60, fully completed, but they will take a few tweaks. And I think the way that Sean selected those 100, because obviously there's a lot of different stories, but we tried to get a wide section of society. And when you're talking about the South Island and Scots, obviously Mackenzie's probably the most well-known. So we really couldn't ignore him. And we thought we'd try and bring a lot of these facts together. And that's when we found there wasn't many facts at all. But so we've tried to be delicate and not tell too many tales. But to give an essence of the man, you've got to kind of you've got to be open to those embellishments at time as well.
Yeah.
Sean, Will, super interesting. I really love these kind of legends. And thanks for joining me and good luck with the rest of the projects. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of things that come out that are really speak to just how tough those generations were.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. It's great to be able to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Jared. Always a pleasure.